Good afternoon. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
People of Western Europe. A landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of a concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies.
The liberation, like the message that signaled it, came in many tongues. The French of Charles de Gaulle.
La bataille suprême est engagée. Après tant de combats, de fureur, de douleur, voici venu le choc décisif.
And a Polish foreign minister in exile.
Żołnierze, lotnicy, marynarze Polacy. Wkraczamy w decydującą fazę generalnej rozgrywki i porachunku z Niemcami.
Those who were there say King Haakon wept as he spoke to Norway.
Landsmen, some did it in store touchy subtan. Some had a sikte for frigøring af Europas undertrykte folk.
There were messages from the Dutch, the Danes, the Luxembourgers, and the Belgians.
Mes chers compatriotes, les opérations préliminaires pour la libération de l'Europe ont commencé.
I call upon all who love freedom to stand with us now. Together we shall achieve victory.
General Dwight D. Eisenhower and other world leaders announcing the invasion of Normandy, and today marks the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Joining us to discuss the importance the invasion had to the war and to America's position on the world stage, Northern Kentucky University Professor of History Dr. Jeffrey Williams, and also Dr. Michael Turney, the former chair of the Northern Kentucky University Communications Department, and also Howard Wilkinson. And if you'd like to join the discussion, you can call 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
70 years ago today, something happened which was just extraordinary. Largest seaborne invasion in the history of the world changed things dramatically in World War II. One of the things I'm interested in from you gentlemen is to get a sense of why the D-Day took place. How it was planned, how the logistics, which must have been just incredible to put together this massive of force, came about.
Well, it's a huge story
involving
many, many months, years, really, involving the British and the Americans in this vast planning operation, anything that's going to involve some 3 million Allied soldiers, sailors, and airmen, 11,000 aircraft, 3,000 naval vessels, requires an extraordinary amount of coordination. And the remarkable thing is, in spite of the inevitable snafus that occurred on the day, that it was carried out as brilliantly as it was. Logistical triumph.
And this was the war had been going on for quite some time, obviously, and the Allied troops have been fighting the Germans on different fronts, North Africa, Sicily, Italy. But, you know, the real goal was to drive into France, through into Germany, and to destroy the German war machine. That was the plan, correct?
Right, and it was also to go to the assistance of the Russians, who'd been holding out more or less on their own for several years, bearing the full brunt of the Nazi war machine. And victory was going to have to come by attacking on a Western front in addition to the Eastern front that the Russians were busy pounding away on.
Now, obviously, this was no surprise to Hitler that there was going to be an invasion. What he did not know was exactly where it would be on the coast of France. Tell us a little bit about the Atlantic Wall that the German forces built.
Well, it was a remarkable piece of engineering that stretched all along the coastline wherever the Germans thought the Allies might come ashore, really from the Pyrenees down on the Spanish-French border all the way up into the Low Countries. And they involved not only German labor, but they conscripted local people to build these vast bunkers that provided shelter for the artillery. They created all of these tidal barriers in the sand, and they brought people in from all over Europe, actually, to do this in an extraordinary effort because, of course, they didn't know exactly where the attack would come, so they had to prepare something all along that vast coastline.
And I think if I could add at this point, I mean, one of the things that was going on beyond the purely physical logistics and the military issues, there were also psychological issues of creation of a fortress and the question of whether or not a huge, you know, invasion force could come in from the sea and retake, because there were people who really doubted this. Mm-hmm. So it was a real concern.
They did the Allies did a pretty good job of deception in terms of keeping the Germans off balance as to where this was going to be. I mean, they thought it was going to be at Calais, which was the narrowest point between Great Britain and France on the English Channel.
That's right.
That was their assumption, and it was wrong.
Right. Well, one of the great triumphs of the Allies was to confuse the issue by actually creating an ersatz army under General George Patton, which he was hung around in southeast England, London, making as if he was about to launch an invasion, when in fact this was all a subterfuge. They actually created railroad sidings. They built barracks that were never used. All was seen by the Germans and misinterpreted as evidence that the attack was going to come there, while they were actually busy preparing the attack in Normandy.
And this invasion might have happened, and we might be remembering it on June 5th instead of June 6th. What happened?
That was the famous confluence of tide, moon, and weather that made it seem like July or June 5th was the ideal day, and then the weather intervened with an unusually strong June storm, and it was impossible to launch, and it was clear that on the 7th, another storm was going to come, so the only opening, the only window that Eisenhower really had to work with was the 6th. And even though he was very unsure as to whether the weather was going to be even good enough that day, he felt he had to go ahead because the conditions would not repeat themselves again in such a favorable way for several weeks.
And he said go.
He said go.
It was very interesting this morning. I saw a video clip from CNN. Obviously, there are, you know, some of the surviving soldiers are over there now. And there was a gentleman who's 93 years old, who was in the 101st Airborne and was one of the thousands of paratroopers who, in the early morning hours, landed behind enemy lines. And today, he repeated that. He actually made the jump again at the age of 93 in his 101st Airborne uniform. But that early morning operation with the paratroopers and the gliders was very important, was it not?
Yeah, absolutely. It was designed to distract the German forces from the impending amphibious landing, and they did a wonderful job. Although most of the airmen or the parachutists ended up off target, in fact, the fact that they were scattered all over the countryside further confused the Germans, who didn't know where to go with their troops, with their reserves. And while they were pondering where this attack was really forming up, that was when the amphibious landing was able to come ashore at Utah Beach, especially successfully, and then also at Omaha.
And the amphibious landing started about 6:30 a.m.
Right.
I guess, you know, most people, a lot of people have seen the movie Saving Private Ryan. If you watch the first 22 minutes of that movie, you get a pretty good sense, I think, of what it was like. We've got, courtesy of Mike, an audio that was Charles Collingwood, who was a famous CBS correspondent, was on the beach, Omaha Beach, that morning, and he had this report.
We are on the beach today, on D-Day. We've just come in. We caught a ride in a small boat which came in from our LST, loaded with 1,000 pounds of TNT, half a ton of high explosive on this beach, which is still under considerable enemy gunfire. These boys are apparently having a pretty tough time in here on the beaches. It's not very pleasant. It's exposed, and it must have been a rugged fight to get it. Looking out to sea, all we can see of the vast invasion fleet which is assembled for us are the silhouettes of the big four ships, the battleships and cruisers, which have been putting a steady bombardment against the enemy positions all day.
That was really amazing. I mean, because that was the first time in the history of warfare that people back home, the parents, the wives, the brothers and sisters of the soldiers who were actually there in the middle of this invasion, could hear a report live.
That's right, Howard. I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, it's dramatic coverage even today.
Right.
I mean, if we heard something like this coming out of the Middle East, we'd say, wow, you know, great coverage. But we wouldn't think beyond that. But in 1944, as you said, people were not hearing news live. What news coverage in early 1944 was one announcer sitting in front of a microphone and reading news reports telling you everything that had happened. But D-Day was the first time they were able to do live reports. And surprisingly, the credit for this really goes to General Eisenhower. In the early planning for D-Day, Eisenhower insisted that live worldwide radio coverage be made possible. His technical advisors said, well, it can't be done. There aren't transmitters that can do that. And Eisenhower's response was, build them. You know, okay. He wanted transmitters so that there could be live coverage. And he wanted it worldwide. He didn't want it just to the U.S. He didn't want it just to Great Britain. He wanted it everywhere, including being beamed into the still captive countries of Europe, which meant for the technical people, they had to develop transmitters that would work with all kinds of different equipment. Because normally, in those days, a German-made radio could not receive signals sent off of an American transmitter or off of a French transmitter. So they had to improve technology basically for all the nations of the world to get that message in. It was an incredible breakthrough, and they pulled it off, and as a result, it changed how radio news was covered for the rest of the war.
Right.
This type of reporting, people like Collingwood were doing other stuff.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation on this 70th anniversary of D-Day. And how do you assess the role of General Eisenhower? Could anyone else have handled that role of Supreme Commander as well as he did?
Well, you'll get into a debate with historians on that topic because, of course, the character of generals is something that historians chew on endlessly. But most do concede the point that he was probably the best executive manager and the best at sort of negotiating the shoals of all of the different temperaments of the various generals he had to play around, and that he did a brilliant job of bringing this otherwise disparate group of egotistical generals together in this common enterprise, people like Montgomery,
right.
You know, de Gaulle. It's remarkable how well he functioned within that context of very prickly personalities with very divergent views of how the war should be won.
Well, I'd like to add to that. I mean, because you go beyond just the military expertise, but Eisenhower was also really tuned into psychology, and he was tuned into what we now recognize as public relations issues. You know, when he said he wanted live coverage of all of this, he wanted to be able to send what amounted to psychological warfare messages into each of the occupied countries in their own language. He insisted on that. He fought with President Roosevelt over that, and you know, finally Roosevelt backed down on that very issue. So I think that was huge. You know, there may have been other generals who may have come close to Eisenhower in military strategy skills, but I don't think they had the additional social skills to pull it off.
We got an email from Robert who says he comments that the Allies had better weather info than the Germans. And he says, had Ike waited for the next full moon, the weather would have been terrible.
I haven't checked the weather forecast for a month ahead, but yeah. Knowing the British Isles, that's quite likely.
Yeah,
more than likely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation.
The invasion itself, I mean, it obviously came in waves. It took a while to be able to secure the beach. But by the end of the day, they had. But
just barely.
Just barely, yeah. But then it was followed by weeks of fighting in the Normandy countryside, trying to break out because of the hedgerows and that sort of thing. That was a difficult period, wasn't it?
Very much so. I mean, the unfortunate fact is a lot of people think that once they got up to the top of the cliff, the war was basically over at that point.
Right.
Nothing further from the truth. You're absolutely right. The British and the Canadians, and by the way, we should not forget that they were very vitally involved in this, ran into tremendous tank battles around the city of Caen in the weeks that followed. The Germans by that time had brought in reserves. The Americans found themselves dealing, as you mentioned before, with the topography of Normandy, which featured these hedgerows that provided perfect cover for German defenders. As American tanks tried to penetrate them, they went up over the hedgerow, exposed their bellies, which were then penetrated by German shells. It was extraordinarily hard fighting, for which most of the Americans had not been prepared. The training had really been how to get off the boats, on the beach, up the cliff, and then what? And most of our American forces were not at all prepared for this. Most of them hadn't really seen combat before, whereas the Germans who were brought in to defend were battle-hardened veterans, and that created a tremendously hard struggle that was only really resolved by mid-August.
Mm. Let's talk with Roger from Castown. Good afternoon, Roger.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is, I wonder if anyone still has his daddy's cricket, and I would give a mighty to have my pa's.
Yeah. Tell us about the cricket. Explain the crickets to us now.
Cricket?
We know.
Actually, it was a frog. It was a little metal frog. It was a child's toy.
Right.
And when you pressed it, it went. And it would carry quite well. And I guess the Brits called it a cricket. But it was used as a signaling device. The paratroopers had them. Most everyone was issued one.
And you clicked
and you
once.
Shaving a haircut or whatever it might be.
And you clicked once, and then the other person would click twice.
Yeah, it could be shaving a haircut. You could, you know, anyone right. You could set it all up.
And that point of that was to make sure that the people who had landed could find out where the others were in the middle of the night, right?
Yes, and these people who my dad worked on this for almost 3 years before it happened. These people, in spite of the hope, they looked at the backside of everything that they possibly could because they knew who they were up against. But here's my final comment. My brother and I kept after that man for years afterwards. He brought home some very evocative souvenirs, helmets and mousers and such, cowhide hat. We just kept after. Come on, Pa. Come on, come on, come on. Finally, one day, he turned around and he said, "You know, boys, you didn't miss much." And that's the last we ever heard of.
Roger.
He was in the third wave at Omaha.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Roger.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it.
One thing I'd like to come back to when we were talking about the invasion, the actual first wave of the invasion, everything was indeed dependent upon the troops coming ashore off of the landing craft. But there was a hope and an expectation that as the war moved into its next stage, that there would be some assistance coming from resistance forces in the occupied countries. And here again, this comes back to some of Eisenhower's foresight with developing the radio communications so he could speak to people in all of these countries. And he could have the leaders who had been deposed speaking to them in their own language. He was trying to promote and encourage resistance, not just from the organized resistance forces, but from the general populations as well. So again, technology came through and was a big help for him in that respect.
Let's talk with Rex, who is on I-75. Good afternoon, Rex.
Hello. I don't have any connection to D-Day other than as a tourist, but I wanted to share an anecdote regarding your comments about Eisenhower's leadership and the different perspective that the British had about Montgomery's role. We went into a wonderful museum there called RMO's 360, which gives you this 360 roundabout film experience of what a 15 minutes was like. And we were walking out to the parking lot with this British couple, and they recognized that we were from America. And the lady turned to us and said, "We never realized the Americans had quite a lot to do with this, didn't they?" So, you know, they thought that this was Montgomery's day in the sun and that Eisenhower was his buddy. But I thought that was a fascinating how travel allows you to see and hear things in different people's eyes. And it was an amazing place, the town of Aramosh, where they created this artificial port and ran these trucks in on pontoon bridges 24/7 because they had calculated every soldier who lands is going to go through 200 pounds of stuff every day. And so the amount of logistical delivery that had to occur in days 2 through 7, and after day 7, that port got blown away by a storm. But it's just an amazing thing.
The amount of planning that went into it was absolutely amazing. Thank you, Rex. We appreciate the comments.
You know, I know there is a lot of debate, and has been a lot of debate over the years about whether or not this was, in fact, the turning point of the war. What's your take on that, Joe?
Well, as historians, we look at the whole war, not just the American part.
Right.
And there's many historians who feel that the Russians' victory over the Germans at Stalingrad and Kursk in 42 and 43 was the real turning point, because they ground the German army down so successfully that when the Americans landed in 44, the army we faced was not nearly as effective a fighting force as it would have been otherwise.
And Hitler could not move troops from France over to the Eastern Front.
Right. On June 22nd, the Russians came through with a massive assault in which they launched 2 million men at the Germans just at the same time as we were fighting desperately in Normandy. So the Russians were crucial in the success of the American campaign in Normandy by creating this enormous diversion to the east. And some would even say Pearl Harbor was an important turning point, because the Japanese decision to attack us there brought us in. We wouldn't otherwise have gotten involved in World War I or II, possibly. And in fact, that was perhaps the most crucial moment, because it fully engaged America's industrial power and manpower in the Allied side, which otherwise probably wouldn't have won the war.
70 years later, why is the story of D-Day still so important to remember?
I think it's important to remember in the context of the entire war effort. It's a dramatic, picturesque moment. It engages our emotions. But it's not the only battle of World War II. And I would argue, especially as we look at the pictures of the French peasants who are welcoming the American veterans back today, every single one of those Norman people had a relative killed during the invasion. We tend to forget how the French suffered dramatically. As many French civilians died on D-Day as Allied soldiers did. They're part of the story, too, and we need to remember the entire picture.
And I think, following up on that, as you indicated, D-Day, the invasion, truly was a multinational, international effort. You know, there were certainly others during the course of the war, but this may have been the most dramatic and on the largest scale, and we can talk about the contributions of all of these different countries, and we can also talk about the fact that all of the countries involved knew the invasion was happening, you know, as it was happening. The occupied countries where the Allies were coming into had been warned in advance that they were coming, and they were getting constant updates. So I do think the whole awareness issue, as well as the breadth of nations involved, does indeed make it huge and makes it memorable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Northern Kentucky University Professor of History, Dr. Jeffrey Williams, Dr. Michael Turney, former chair of the Northern Kentucky University Communications Department, and WVXU's Howard Wilkinson. After the break, a look at the growing popularity of soccer and a look at the World Cup, which starts next week. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.